long struggle to give us some hope, because Harry Belafonte, in his 90s now, he's an angry man. He's still angry. He knows that the civil rights movement, in which he was absolutely instrumental, it did not succeed at nearly all that he hoped. The struggle is long. So what do you do, he says. He says, it's not so much where your anger comes from, it's what you do with it. And what do? You sing your song, and then you give it away. You take it from the top, and you keep singing. This is this call to an imagination, a thread of beauty that I try to run through this dark story, because I think if we're going to find our way through the Trumpocene, it's not going to be by returning to some normal that was never that great, but by following the model of these long ago singers, in many ways, unfortunately forgotten, but had a vision of a liberationist politics.
This is KBOO Portland.
Fascism in a way that Chuck Schumer, say, cannot.
Jeff Charlotte, we want to thank you so much.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time station manager to oversee administrative, fundraising, and business functions. Nonprofit management experience required. To apply, go to kboo.fm/station manager hire or visit our website. Deadline to apply is Friday, April 7th. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, students in Portland join in a national protest calling for an end to gun violence. Advocates push Oregon lawmakers to renew a plan calling for fewer prisoners and fewer prisons.
Since it began, Justice Reinvestment has prevented two prisons from opening and has shuttered two more.
And some in Washington state say wealthier people should pay more to fund caregiving. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 6, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Portland students left class yesterday in order to protest against gun violence. Their efforts are part of a national walkout. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Hundreds of Portland students participated in a protest against gun violence yesterday. They started at Terry Schrunk Plaza, marched through downtown Portland, and ended at City Hall. The protest took place during school hours, starting around noon. It was part of a national walkout organized by Students Demand Action, taking place across the country. Students here held signs with gun violence statistics and messages about valuing children more than firearms. They gave impassioned speeches demanding action from legislators and elected officials. While several participants were seen climbing the walls of City Hall, the gathering appeared to be peaceful. Gun violence at schools remains a national problem. The United States saw yet another deadly shooting recently, this one at a Christian school in Nashville, Tennessee, with three children dying in that incident. Just weeks ago, two Portland high school students were among three killed in a shooting in North Portland. Rain Conley, an eighth grader at Northwest Academy, helped organize the Portland walkout, along with students from Lincoln High School and the Metropolitan Learning Center. Conley asked how many more students have to die before officials take action to fight gun violence and significantly restrict access to firearms. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
For years now, one goal in the Oregon legislature has been to reduce the prison population and cut down on the number of prisons. And a big program that does this is hanging in the balance. Shannon White is deputy director at the nonprofit Partnership for Safety and Justice. It's a group that pushes for alternatives to keep people accountable for crimes, but that don't involve prison. She explains the group's key priority this legislative session.
So the first legislative policy priority we want to talk about is the Justice Reinvestment Program. Justice Reinvestment is a 10-year-old policy that decreased prison sentences and invested resources into all of Oregon's 36 counties. Many of you who are longtime advocates will remember that 10 years ago, Oregon had 14 state prisons, and there were plans to break ground on a 15th injunction city. Incarceration rates were skyrocketing and had been since the beginning of mass incarceration in the early 90s. In 2013, alongside many of you, other community allies, and legislative champions, PSJ advocated for an approach that lowered prison sentences and invested savings from averted prison costs back into our communities to support local resources such as housing, treatment, employment, and crime survivor services. Since it began, Justice Reinvestment has prevented two prisons from opening and has shuttered two more. Now Oregon has 12 open prisons when we would have otherwise had 16. We have saved Oregon taxpayers over $500 million in prison costs and invested hundreds of millions into counties. Even with all that success, every program needs accountability, and we've brought that to Justice Reinvestment. Most significantly, we've done that with you by passing sentencing reforms that ensured the women's prison population was on track to get smaller, and passing legislation to ensure that Justice Reinvestment funds are getting to culturally specific services to meet the needs of Black and Brown Oregonians. So then, with all that success, why are we talking about Justice Reinvestment 10 years later? Because it's an ongoing and important program that is scheduled to sunset after 10 years, which happens to be right now, and we need to advocate to extend the sunset and for its continued funding. There's no opposition to this bill that we know of, but funding's never assured, especially when the budget is tight like it is right now. So we want to make sure that lawmakers know how important Justice Reinvestment has been to Oregon. We'll be asking legislators to support $61 million to the Criminal Justice Commission for continued funding for JRI, and also ask them to extend the sunset for another 10 years. We need to keep Oregon on this critical track of shrinking our correction system and investing in community-based solutions.
That's Shannon White, who serves as the deputy director at the nonprofit Partnership for Safety and Justice in Oregon. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, and Oregon Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici joined U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo as she visited Hillsborough yesterday. Raimondo is visiting states as she begins the process of winnowing down where billions of dollars in CHIPS Act investment will go as part of the president's plan to build back American manufacturing. Here are some of the remarks the Commerce Secretary made, edited for Time.
It'll be competitive. There'll be an application process. We'll be starting that in the fall, and then we'll go from there. But I'll tell you this, it will be competitive, and based on what I've seen here today, I think you will be extremely competitive. What you have here, 15% of all the workforce in the industry is here in Oregon, the leading companies here in Oregon, a governor and a congressional delegation getting behind it. There is a lot to like, and I can't wait to see your application. I said put in an application, and I think you have so many resources. Let me say a few things. Not every state has 15% of the workforce of the semiconductor industry already in it. Not every state has a CHIPS Act, a state CHIPS Act, which includes very smart investments like worker training, site selection, and investments in companies. Not every state has, you know, world-class community colleges that are already working with industry. So, as I said, it's competitive, of course, but what you have here is quite exceptional. It is daunting. There is no doubt about it. It is daunting. It's the most, it's the biggest, most exciting, most important industrial strategy since the Second World War. It's huge, but we're up to the challenge and we have to do it. Let me say this. We didn't get here overnight. We're not going to get out overnight. It has been a slow, about 40 years of taking our eye off the ball of manufacturing. But we are making investments of the size and scale that we never had before in manufacturing. And as Senator Wyden said several times, and he's a huge champion in the Senate for this, we need to recommit ourselves to making things in America, advanced manufacturing in America. And this, you can't underestimate the magnitude of this investment. Everything that I've seen here today at the community college, from the universities, we had Senator Wyden and Congresswoman Bonamici hosted with me and the governor an amazing group of companies before, almost 20 of them. It's world class. The way you're thinking about job training, investments in technology, investments in infrastructure, the governor is committed to making permitting streamlined. You're doing everything right. and we just have to partner with you to help you be successful.
That was U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo visiting Hillsboro, Oregon yesterday. People who work at nursing homes and as in-home caregivers rallied at the Washington State Capitol in Olympia yesterday. They're supporting budget proposals that would raise taxes on the wealthy and fix the state's so-called regressive tax system. Eric Tegedoff has that story.
In-home caregivers and nursing home workers rallied in Olympia Wednesday to show support for lawmakers' budget and call for more revenue in the future. The Washington House and Senate fully fund long-term care in their proposed budgets for 2023 to 2025. The proposals would raise starting wages for in-home caregivers to $21 per hour and more than $25 for more experienced caregivers. Shelley Hughes is a certified nursing aide at a nursing home in Bellingham, who says increased pay is critical for workers.
None of us are doing this job to get rich. We do it because we have big hearts and we know that no one else is going to do it. But have you seen the price of eggs, or the price of gas, the price of rent? There are people who want to do this work and end up leaving because they literally can't feed their families.
More than 200 caregivers gathered at the Capitol on Wednesday. They celebrated the proposed support from lawmakers, but also called for them to reform the state's tax policy. A 2018 study found Washington had the most regressive tax system in the country, meaning lower-income residents pay a much larger portion of their wages in taxes than wealthy Washingtonians. Hughes says new workers are leaving the profession and can't be replaced fast enough to take pressure off other caregivers.
We really need a sustainable long-term fix for this problem. And that's new funding so that we can raise wages, so that we can get more people, so we can keep more people, so we can provide excellent care.
Lawmakers are working out the state budget as the 2023 session winds down. It's set to adjourn on April 23rd. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
People in the disability community in Nevada say more needs to be done to address their housing concerns. As Alex Gonzalez reports, lawmakers are looking at a bill that would raise property taxes in order to boost supportive housing.
While some Nevada laws, such as SB 68, aim to increase supportive housing for those with behavioral, mental, and physical disabilities, others say such proposals simply don't go far enough when it comes to accessible housing. Ace Patrick is a member of the disability community in Nevada and says they know firsthand the struggle of having to look for housing. Patrick says not only does more need to be done to get at the root of the problem, which many with disabilities face, but lawmakers need to do better in listening to their disabled constituents who have unique challenges.
I really do believe we need to do more cooperative living here. I think we're kind of missing a mark on that. We need more intentional community housing. We need multi-generational housing. We need housing where you've got people of all incomes.
Patrick says Betty's Village in Las Vegas, an independent living community for adults with disabilities, is a model for what housing should look like for all disabled Nevadans across the state. They say the establishment is compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Patrick says as an advocate for their community, they feel issues brought up to Nevada legislators fall on deaf ears. Patrick commends Assemblywoman Tracy Brown May and Leslie Cohen for listening to the concerns of those in the disability community, but realizes that it's only 2 lawmakers out of many. Patrick adds the Nevada Statewide Independent Living Council is aiming to get more individuals with disabilities directly involved in the legislative process.
We may give public comment, or we may say, hey, this is not going to work for us, and then the bills get passed. Where does that say? That says that, you know, it's very significant. You know, we allowed you some space to talk, but beyond that, we're going to do what we're going to do.
Patrick says many intellectual and developmentally disabled individuals are struggling to make ends meet on fixed incomes, a problem exacerbated with increasing housing costs. They say many fortunate individuals receive help to pay rent from family members, but adds that isn't a permanent fix to the issue. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
As the climate continues to change, conservationists are coming up with plans to try to protect key lands and water that people and nature both need to survive. Eric Galatas takes a look at one such plan in Colorado.
As Colorado faces mounting challenges associated with the changing climate, record-breaking wildfires, extreme drought, and dwindling water supplies, the loss of habitat for native plants and animals, a new roadmap aims to help secure the state's most critical natural resources by doubling the footprint of conserved lands over the next 10 years. Linda LaDove with the group Keep It Colorado says people who have lived in the area for centuries, along with recent transplants, share a lot of the same values about the place they call home.
The wide open scenic vistas, the strong agricultural heritage and way of life, the outdoor recreation economy, the wildlife here. This plan is really about finding ways to protect those things.
About 60% of lands in Colorado are privately owned, and the roadmap aims to help landowners ensure that their life's work, producing food, protecting waterways, wildlife habitat, and plant biodiversity, can continue long after they retire. Conserving key parcels now is important, LaDove says, because while there will always be opportunities to build more, we can never get back natural spaces once they're partitioned and sold off for development. The roadmap offers guidance to engage all of the state's communities in conservation and emphasizes the need to protect lands that carry Colorado's most valuable natural asset. LaDove says the work will require creating partnerships with a host of stakeholders, including the Colorado Water Conservation Board, basin roundtables, watershed councils, and other groups focused on water.
Working with water conservation partners on different solutions and opportunities that protect water for nature and people, because land is connected to water and water is connected to land, and we really need both.
Water is one of five strategic focus areas in the plan. LaDove says all Coloradans stand to benefit if the effort to boost the number of conserved privately owned lands from 3.3 million acres to 6.6 million acres is successful. She adds there are many ways people can help conserve lands that puts food on our tables, protects wildlife, and protects a way of life.
We encourage people to vote with their values, advocating for good policy, writing to their legislators, volunteering with their local land trust.
This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, it'll be cloudy out there. We'll get about half an inch of rain, an overnight low down to 48. Tomorrow's weather, that steady light rain in the morning, showers continue in the afternoon. We'll reach a high temperature of 54. Today in history, on this date in 1917, the United States officially entered World War I with a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives, a 373-50. The quote of the day is from Ernest Hemingway, "Never think that war, no matter how necessary nor how justified, is not a crime." Voters in Wisconsin decide to dramatically change the balance of their state Supreme Court with national implications. Progressives win in the election of a former teacher, Brandon Johnson, as the next mayor of Chicago. And a Democratic lawmaker in North Carolina defects to the Republican Party. With more of the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Well, Wisconsin, guess what? We did it! We did it!
Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Janet Protasiewicz celebrates following her high-stakes win in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race. The election outcome shifts majority control of the high court to liberals for the first time in 15 years and will likely determine the fate of the state's abortion ban and GOP-drawn legislative maps. Protasiewicz defeated former Justice Dan Kelly, who advised Republicans to use fake GOP electors in the 2020 presidential election. Brandon Johnson, a union organizer and former public school teacher, was elected mayor of Chicago.
Make no mistake about it, Chicago is a union town.
Johnson beat former Chicago Public Schools CEO Paul Vallis with help from the Chicago Teachers Union to succeed Mayor Lori Lightfoot. Johnson said his win represented a victory for a bold progressive movement. Crime and policing dominated the campaign. A North Carolina state lawmaker elected as a Democrat has announced her move to the GOP, giving Republicans a veto-proof supermajority in the state's legislature. Representative Tricia Contham would not comment on how her defection might change her position on abortion rights.
I'm going to look inside and I'm going to pray on this issue. And I know that's where I will find the answer, as I do on everything.
Contham represents the heavily Democratic Mecklenburg County. Democrats are calling on her to resign. In Tennessee, Republican lawmakers are working to expel three Democrats, saying they brought disorder and dishonor to the state house for taking part in a protest calling for gun safety laws. Representative Gloria Johnson says they committed no crime.
They are going with the NRA and the Tennessee Firearms Association instead of listening to the people of Tennessee. They're allowing children to die while doing nothing.
Hundreds of protesters gathered at the Capitol following the Nashville school shooting that left three adults and three children dead. EPA Administrator Michael Regan says his agency will strengthen limits on mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants, updating standards imposed more than a decade ago.
The good people at EPA are ready to take advantage of what we've learned from the past rules and what we've gained in terms of technological advancements.
Research shows mercury and other pollutants from power plants can harm the brain development of young children. Former Vice President Mike Pence will reportedly not appeal a judge's ruling requiring him to testify before a grand jury examining the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. Pence could be a key witness in the special counsel's investigation into former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Tribal leaders in California are asking their state's lawmakers to do more to stop the fentanyl crisis, which is devastating communities. And a federal grand jury indicts a New Mexico man connected to the case of a missing woman on the Navajo Nation. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with today's edition of National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal grand jury has indicted a New Mexico man in the case of a missing elderly woman on the Navajo Nation. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports Ella Mae Begay remains missing after more than a year and a half.
The two-count indictment alleges that 23-year-old Preston Henry Tolth assaulted Begay during a June 2021 carjacking in Sweetwater, Arizona, a community near Four Corners on the Navajo Nation. Prosecutors say Tolth drove Begay's Ford F-150 pickup truck across state lines and intended to cause death or serious bodily harm to her. Tolth faces decades in prison if convicted. The investigation by the FBI and Navajo Nation law enforcement is ongoing, and the U.S. Justice Department says it's part of a broader attempt to solve cases of missing and murdered indigenous people. Begay's family has aggressively sought answers in her disappearance. In a social media post, an attorney representing them said the day of the indictment was bittersweet. Last summer, Begay's niece, Seraphine Warren, walked from the Navajo Nation to Washington, D.C. to advocate for her aunt and other missing and murdered indigenous people. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
Winona LaDuke has resigned as executive director of the environmental group Honor the Earth. The board of directors received and accepted her resignation this week. The move comes after a Minnesota jury last week sided with a former employee. Margaret Campbell had complained a coworker sexually harassed her. Campbell claimed Honor the Earth's leaders failed to take her concerns seriously. The Becker County jury awarded Campbell $750,000 in damages for sexual harassment and retaliation. Honor the Earth released a statement on Facebook Wednesday from the new executive director, Crystal Tubols. In the statement, Tubols talks about moving Honor the Earth forward with the transition after LaDuke's leadership of more than 30 years. The statement does not mention the lawsuit, but Tubols says they've learned real lessons and have deep work to do around sexual harassment. She goes on to say Honor the Earth is committed to listening, healing, and intentional work ahead. In a Facebook post, LaDuke wrote that she failed former employee Molly Campbell for failing to respond to her reports of sexual harassment by a coworker. LaDuke says prior to the trial, she had been working on a transition plan. Tribal leaders in California ask state lawmakers to help address the fentanyl crisis impacting their communities. During a recent roundtable at the state capitol in Sacramento, tribal leaders shared how fentanyl is devastating Native Americans across the state. Chairman John Chrisman of the Viejas Band of Mission Indians, who's been in tribal leadership for 16 years, has served as chairman for the last four. He says it's plaguing his people, and it's like nothing he's seen before.
Part of the reasons that we don't have any successes because this new sort of chemical takes a hold of them. And when you look in their eyes, they can't, it's like they need a stepping program to get off of this in order to even get through it. Get through to them at all.
Chairwoman Angela Elliott Santos of the Manzanita Band of Kumeyaay Nation talked about how she's lost close family members. She says challenges include being in a rural area with lack of resources, law enforcement, and services. She says what tribes need is full funding, which they don't have to compete for, in order to tackle the issue.
Funding we can count on to end the cycles that have plagued us since we were stripped of our way of life. In these days of so much talk of equity and making up for the past, our tribes are still in the same position they've been in for decades, nowhere close to having the resources to truly help our people.
Santos also stressed the need for collaboration, especially for law enforcement and mental health crisis support. The discussion was led by Native American Assemblymember James Ramos, who says the roundtable was held for legislators to learn recommendations for a stable government-to-government solution. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It's April, and in honor of this Arts Month, some California groups are pressing for more workforce diversity and opportunity. Suzanne Potter has more on that story.
April is the fifth annual Arts, Culture, and Creativity Month in California, and advocates for the arts are promoting diversity in the arts workforce and celebrating recent policy wins. In Los Angeles, the County Board of Supervisors just voted to join Arts for LA's Creative Jobs Collective Impact Initiative, which aims to create 10,000 living wage jobs in the state's creative sector by the year 2030. Arts for LA CEO Gustavo Herrera says the idea is to rebuild the arts economy after COVID.
We really are focusing on centering youth and adults from historically underrepresented communities. Here in Los Angeles, approximately 59% or nearly three-fifths of our arts workforce currently self-identify as white.
The collective's steering committee is putting together recommendations on legislation, budget investments, joint programming, data accountability, and collective communication efforts, and will report back to the board in October. Find out more about arts advocacy at artforla.org. Meanwhile, artists, advocates, and policymakers are gathering in Sacramento for an arts and culture summit on April 17th, followed by a rally and meetings with lawmakers on the 18th. Herrera says April is a perfect time to get involved.
So it's so important that we have a strong community of advocates really pushing for arts and culture in every community, and then also to just go out and experience the arts and celebrate all the creativity across the state.
The summit will celebrate recent policy wins for the arts sector, including the passage of Prop 28 last year, which will direct millions more per year toward arts education. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 6, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Eric Galatis, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for listening tonight. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. So if you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. That's coming up next.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. Earlier this year, a series of street protests and strikes began in Israel in response to the far-right government's push for broad judicial reform. But unless the people in the streets manage to pull together a coalition that can win a national election, it will be difficult for them to stop the government's plan from being implemented. Ian Lustig is a retired professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania who believes that what's going on in Israel amounts to a kind of civil war, and he suggests that the protesters could learn a little bit from the American Civil War. Lustig spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
A civil war in Israel? Do you really think it's that intense, that serious? Can you really compare it with the American Civil War? I mean, we know that there's been division in Israel between, say, the secular people and the religious people, between Likud and Labor, but how do you see it now? Sounds like it's more serious.
Yeah, I am not suggesting that we're going to see 600,000, the demographic equivalent of 600,000 people killed in a four-year battle. I don't see the United States case as a script for Israel's future. What I'm trying to point out is that, among other things, this is the correct time frame for thinking and the correct weightiness of the issues. That is, in the American Civil War,